Succession number 18684, Real One.
Peter Bird, Real One. Where were you born, please?
Well, I'm a native of West Kirby, but my parents moved at the time of my birth to Morton, which is about 5 miles away. So I was technically born in Morton, but we came back to West Kirby when I was about 3 years old. So I regard myself as being a native of West Kirby.
We should say that these places are in the Wirral.
In the Wirral, indeed, yes. And the date, of course, was 1923, 6th of January.
Can you tell me about where you were educated, please?
Yes, I was educated at the Calday Grange Grammar School here on the top of the hill at West Kirby. And I got my school certificate and left school in 1939.
Just as the war was starting?
Indeed, yes. And straight after school, I applied for an office boy's job in the local town hall at Hoylake, and I was there from 1939 until I was called up in 1942. And because the older members of staff had been called up, I rapidly was passed from being an office boy to being a clerk in the rates department, and then finished up as deputy chief cashier for the urban district of Hoylake at the age of 19. So those 3 years were quite valuable in training, really, office training and things.
Had you heard Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes. I heard the broadcast where he said that Hitler has not obliged and that we were now at war with Germany. I did hear that.
And what were your feelings about that?
Well, I thought it was pretty horrific. You know, I thought this was a very serious situation because my father had fought in the First World War, and he had, of course, a set of books with pictures of people being gassed and things, and I felt this was going to be a repeat, you know, at that stage.
Did the war affect you much in North Wirral in those first 3 years of the war?
Well, yes. I couldn't give you exact dates, but we have, just a mile off the coast, Hilbury Island, and they burnt flares there to be a decoy. So quite a number of incendiaries were dropped here on the shore. And I also volunteered in that period to be assistant ARP warden, and I frequently patrolled my street, Riversdale Road it was, and we had splinters dropping on the roofs, you know, shell splinters and things like that. And we had a grandstand view of the Blitz in Liverpool in 1940, around about that period.
Did any bombs fall near your home?
Not in West Kirby, but with my connection with the Urban District Council, I joined the rescue squad sort of department, and going to an incident in New Brighton, a lorry carrying some of my colleagues of the rescue squad received a direct hit from a bomb. And, of course, they were all killed. And that was between here and New Brighton. So that was near enough for me.
What was people's morale like at that time, civilian morale?
Oh, I should say that I didn't detect any depression or anything. I think everyone just faced up to it and said, well, this is a situation, we've got to cope with it. My father, for instance, and I built a shelter in our front garden and in the lawn, about 5 or 6 feet deep. And because he's in timber, it was lined with offcuts of mahogany. of all things. And we put sandbags on the top, and we, for the first year, I suppose, we used to troop down there when the siren went, but gradually we felt that it was unnecessary.
Did you, when the crisis came in 1940, feel that the country was in danger of losing the war?
There were times when I felt it certainly wasn't going our way, particularly with the news coming in of the North Africa campaign, and of course when we lost the Hood, and you know, that was, to me at the time, very significant, a great loss.
Were you intent on going into the Navy?
Well, yes and no. Earlier on, when I was about 16, I'd gone on holiday with my parents to Trosyth in Wales with some friends. And we went on a fishing boat. And there were my elder brother and myself, and two other sons were there. And because they were older than me, they were all up on deck, and I was put down the hold behind a paraffin engine. And I was so violently sick that my parents had decided that no way could I go to sea. Father was in the army, of course. So that they got quite a shock one day when I came back and said, I've just signed on for the Navy. But, you see, after leaving school and whilst I was working at the town hall, I also became a founder member of the Sea Cadets in our locality, and it was before we had anything like uniforms or anything. We used to meet together at a school in Hoylake, and I was immediately appointed their PTI. So I suppose I ought to go back now and say I was a founder member. But that was how my interest in the Navy developed.
Did you learn anything with the Sea Scouts that was to be of useful to you later?
Sea Cadets. As distinct from Sea Scouts. But, no, one incident was that in mixing with them, and knowing I'd been to the grammar school and got school certificate, they said, why didn't I put in for the Y scheme? I didn't know what it was, but they said, well, you get earmarked for officer-like qualities and things. When you join up. And so when, in September 1942, my papers came, I got two sets. One was for calling me up in the normal way, called up for the Navy, and the other set of papers was for the Y scheme. And so I went to the recruiting office in Renshaw Street in Liverpool, and the chief petty officer sort of greeted me, and I showed him two sets of papers, and he said, oh, well, you won't need these, will you, sir? And he ripped up the Y scheme once. So I was actually called up as bell bottoms as a rating, which was fine with me. I didn't worry about it, but I was so green I didn't realize the significance. Later on, I was quite glad that I wasn't on the Y scheme, because obviously they were selected, I went to HMS Rowley down near Plymouth, and in the first 3 months sort of disciplinary training, a chap with a white cap band was a target for the rest as much as anything. You know, they ribbed him. So I thought, oh gosh, I might have been like that. But there you are. Then that was my entry into the Navy. It was really my normal call up at the age of 19.
So after being called up, you went down south?
HMS Rowley, yes, that's where I initially reported with a travel voucher, of course. And I did 3 months disciplinary training.
What was that like?
Well, square bashing and learning how to knots and splices of ropes, rule of the road, naval history, the usual sort of indoctrination, I suppose.
How did the people in charge treat you there?
Oh, very well indeed. They had an old, retired chief petty officer, gunnery type, who really looked after us well and did his utmost to teach us and show us how to splice ropes and things, I said, I'd give him full marks. I felt he did a good job.
So you felt it was useful to you?
Oh, yes, yes, as a grounding to what was ahead. It's carried me on. I mean, I still love on holiday, you know, pick up bits of rope and start putting eye splices in just because I enjoy doing it. And that's where it all started. Of course, I'd done a little bit for the Sea Cadets before I went down there, but nothing in a professional sense.
Were there any enemy air attacks whilst you were there?
Not that I can recall.
And after you'd finished there?
From Raleigh, I was sent up to Troon to learn, as it were, on Mark III LCTs, that's a tank landing craft. And that, of course, was January, February time. It was pretty tough going because there were early, Mark III was an early version of the tank landing craft. And we did practice beaching, and there was a 10-ton ramp at the forward end, which we had to wind up by hand, you know, with a winch on a couple on each side. And during that short period of training, we also had to learn to splice 3.5 FSWR, which is flexible steel wire rope. And splicing 3.5-inch flexible steel wire rope by hand takes some doing, I can tell you. But whilst I was at Troon, the warrant officer approached me and said, haven't you got your school certificate? And I said, yes. He said, well, why don't you put in for being an officer? And I said, well, I don't want to. I would sooner get my hook, as it were, your anchor on your arm, which meant that you're a leading seaman, because then I was a very ordinary seaman. And I wanted to, as it were, graduate and become a leading seaman. That was the end of that conversation. But the next thing that happened was that I was sent, typical of the Navy, I suppose, down to Calshot at the end of Southampton Water to do a course on Oerlikon, learning how to strip down Oerlikon guns and anti-aircraft guns. You're probably familiar with that. And so it was whilst I was down there at Calshot that a signal came for ordinary seaman Bird to report to Inverary. So you see, I'd gone from Troon to Calshot now to Inverary. And I wasn't told what for. We had a 27-hour journey in the train up to Inverary. We were met, of course, by lorry at Aracha, which is the station. And when we got into the Nissen huts, I was told that it was for a board. Well, to me in those days, a board was a plank of wood, you know. But the next morning, we were told to smarten ourselves up. And, of course, I went up to the castle at Inverary, told to sit down in a chair at one side of a table, and the other was a row of top brass, you know, people with scrambled eggs on their hats. And their first question is, why do you want to be an officer? And I said, well, I don't. I think that might be a little bit unique. They said, what was your father? So I told them he was a manager of a sawmill in Bootle. And where did you go to school? And were you ever captain of your football team or cricket team and all this? And I was then dismissed and went back to our Nissen hut. And the next morning, we were put in a lorry, sent to the station to get the train up to Loch Ilord, which was the officers' training establishment. Of course, I was terribly green then. I didn't really know what it was all about. But on that train journey, we, in the same carriage, had a petty officer and got talking to him. And he said that he was going to Loch Eilert. And I said, well, where have you come from? Oh, he said, I was the PTI, the physical training instructor, at Preston Glass House, which was the National Penitentiary, or whatever you call it. And sure enough, he was the PTI at Loch Eilert. And it seemed to me that his favourite trick was to get our whole class to climb up a rope in a very large Nissen hut and go hand over hand across a girder in the roof. And when you got to the second rope where you descend, he used to shout the naval order, still, which is a gunnery order. If you had a misfire, then everybody must absolutely freeze, nobody must move until that's been corrected. So when we got on this girder, a whole class of us, about a dozen of us, he used to shout, still, and wait there till the first man dropped off, and then we were allowed to proceed, you know, that sort of thing. Fairly tough going.
Dropped off what distance?
Well, it would be at least 12 feet high, I suppose, and you've got the length of the man. He'd drop about 4 or 5 feet. But it was just a disciplinary thing. And our routine there was to get up at 6 in the morning and do 20 minutes flashing Morse code, signalling and semaphore, and then 20 minutes PT, continuous, and then back for breakfast. And then we'd have lessons during the day on seamanship, naval history, rule of the road, that sort of thing, victualling, admiralty rules and regulations. And then at tea time, just when you're ready for tea, we were sent on a 5-mile cross-country run across the Scottish mountains. But to get out of the camp, we had to swim the River Eilert, which was about 30 yards wide. And this, I repeat, was in January, February, March in 1943. And then we did our 5-mile cross-country run. And at the end of that, they said, right, now you can do the assault course. And so we were ready for our tea. And this was almost every day this happened. Another incident there, which I thought was fascinating, was that they lined up, tallest on the right, shortest on the left, in pairs, and put us in the boxing ring. And I think that was within the first couple of days of getting there, if I remember rightly. And, of course, we had to slug it out for just 3 rounds, 2 minutes each or something, just to see how we got on and reacted. And one of our draft was a middleweight belt for Wales, for boxing. So he slaughtered his opponent. And, of course, all the officers are sitting there in the front row, officers and Wren officers, enjoying the spectacle, I feel. And he jagged it in the course after 2 weeks because it was too tough for him. And that was his story. So I remember at that time, I said, no way am I giving up. You know, I'm going to see this through. And, of course, we did. And we eventually had exams at the end of the course, 3 months course. And I passed. I mean, most of us passed. And it was incredible that having been given our certificate, our results, and passed to be an officer, we were then invited up to the wardroom to take tea with the officers. So the contrast between 3 months flogging away in a Nissen hut with a coke stove for warmth, the contrast of going into the castle, Loch Eilert Castle, and having tea with the officers was absolutely astonishing to me. And next morning I was given first class travel bond So even though I was in bell bottoms and had my hammock and my kit bag, I was travelling first class from the station down to Fort William and back home. And the first thing I did, of course, was order a huge breakfast, Scottish porridge and bacon and eggs, and I thought I was in heaven, really. But that was the contrast between the training and once you're qualified, then you've got the perks, as it were. So I went home then to await my posting. And the first posting that I got was to HMS Medina in Ryde, Isle of Wight. I think, of course, Jim Jarman mentions it in his book. And that was a landing craft base where we were training to organize these former Thames lighters, which had been converted with Chrysler Marine engines and a ramp in the stern. And we were trying to work them up into flotillas of 12 craft. Well, it was there, I'd only been there about a month, I think, when I was sent for by the executive commander, who said that I was being dispatched to Whitehall to act as a staff officer on the staff of Captain Harrison Wallace, who was Captain Landing Barges. So my official title was SOO3, which is Staff Officer Operations number three. And of course we were preparing for this large exercise called Exercise Jansen, which was to take place based on Tenby in South Wales. And the first, second, and I think third flotillas sailed from the Isle of Wight along the south coast, round Land's End and across the Bristol Channel to Tenby. My part in this, acting as a staff officer, of course, was to assist in sort of commandeering. I think mine was the Bay Hotel. And there was another one called the Norton Hotel that I can remember. And this was to accommodate the crews once they arrived from this long voyage. And also the naval headquarters were situated at Laston House, which was on the quay at Tenby. And of course I was watch keeping there for the whole exercise, and there were a lot was learned. They were putting stores ashore, unloading coasters, landing the goods across the beaches, and army were supposedly advancing as far as Birmingham from that beachhead. That was the general idea, as I understood it. And there were two other sub-lieutenants. There's one called Rochier, another one called Hutton, and I were watch-keeping at the naval headquarters. And strangely enough, I, looking in my suitcase recently, found the deck log for that exercise, which may be of considerable interest to people who want to research it. At the end of the exercise, when the senior members were returning to London, I asked permission to put some sea time in, and so I was appointed there and then by Captain Harrison Wallace to the first LBV flotilla. So I returned on LBV 208 from Tenby we finished up at Yarmouth at the time in the Isle of Wight, and I actually have still got the deck log for that voyage, which may again be of interest somewhere. But once we got back to Yarmouth, so far as my memory goes, I was then with Ernie Flack was the flotilla officer, and Bill Ensor was the other divisional officer, and we were transferred to HMS Dragonfly, based on Hayling Island.
What was HMS Dragonfly?
It's a naval base.
A shore base.
A shore base at Hayling Island, where the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and I think 4th LBV flotillas were based, and the craft were kept in Langston Harbour. And we then basically were working up to doing exercises about once a month. And we'd go along, you know, with sailing orders and all the rest, and rendezvous with coasters at, say, Pool off the beaches, or Bracklesham springs to mind, I think that's somewhere near Bournemouth. Amroth and Saundersfoot were up at Tenby. They were on the exercise Janssen. And these exercise, series of exercises, were called Cropper 1, Cropper 2, Cropper 3, was the code name for these exercises. I well remember at Studland Bay, which I think is near Poole, weather blew up quite severely, and after the exercise I had a signal from senior officer complimenting the barge I was on as being one of only two that managed to turn around, go astern and make a landing on the whole exercise. The weather was so bad, but I've still got that signal. But that sort of thing, you know, as one reminisces, stands out.
What were the main problems in handling these landing barges?
Well, the main problem, was they were designed for river work. They were never designed to go to sea. They were flat-bottomed. They were ungainly. That's why they call those wallowing beauties in Jim Jarman's book. And originally they were dumb lighters. I don't know, you must be familiar with the fact that Stalin was desperately keen for us to open up a second front and so take some of the pressure off from the Eastern Front. And Louis Mountbatten was appointed Chief of Combined Operations and commandeered about 1,000 Thames lighters. In the early days, they decided that these lighters would be loaded up with stores, ammunition, food. Sorry about that. And they would be taken by tugs and towed over and put on the enemy beach. That was at a time in 1942 when we had very few landing craft of any sort, no purpose-built landing craft. And so when the Americans came into the war under Leasland, we obviously got, I don't know how many, possibly 1,000 Chrysler Marine engines. And so they decided to convert these dumb lighters and put a ramp in the stern, a watertight bulkhead, twin Chrysler Marine engines, and a steering wheelhouse box thing on the starboard side aft,